This is Romany Arrowsmith from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from 17 and Rookie magazines. Hi, guys. The theme for today is going to be speaking your truth. And the first article that I'll read today is from Rookie magazine, and it's called Load Shedding by Simone Shah. My sister told me she lost all hope the second she realized there were bits of bacon in the pasta sauce. She later whispered to me, as I sat on the counter and watched her fix her red lipstick in the bathroom before dessert, "Bacon is the last straw. The worst Muslims will drink or won't pray. They will do it all, but they refuse to eat pork. The second they start eating bacon, you know they're gone. That's like the final sin." We returned to the table and watched our mother, in the process of clearing up, swipe the sauce off the spoon with her finger and place it in her mouth. This is supposed to be a housewarming party for us, but it did not feel very welcoming. The new house was filled with friends of our mother's new boyfriend. There was no one from the circle of my father's college friends and their family members that had long been part of our social life. "Don't say anything, Merrose. Be grateful," my sister warned. Mariam, who had spent the entirety of the summer antagonizing our mother, was now her defender. The summer before I was meant to start high school, my mother decided she was done being my mother. After my father walked out of our apartment in Berkeley one night without warning, she sent us to Karachi to live with her mother, promising it would only be for 3 weeks, then a month, and then she stopped making promises altogether, ending the conversation before it even began by explaining that her phone plan did not allow for expensive international calls. My grandmother told nosy third cousins and her bank teller at HSBC that the move was temporary until she could get back on her feet, omitting the fact that during the 2 months where my mother was supposed to be fixing her marriage, she had quit her job as an ultrasound technician for Kaiser, stopped paying the rent for my childhood home, and moved in with a white man 10 years older than her. If our mother were to get back on her feet now, her old shoes would not fit her. For their last anniversary present, my parents left us. They had us stay with our next-door neighbor for the week and loaned Mariam the Toyota so she could take us to school. The door slammed shut on us, a reminder that Karachi, their birthplace, and their lives before us was no place for us. They returned home with an entire suitcase full of gifts for us. Boxes of quality street, shawls, gold jewelry, and artwork for our bedroom walls. They reminded us that they loved us, that they loved each other. They said that we would love Karachi. Inshallah, one day, when it was not so dangerous, we would see it. The night they returned home, my mother showed us how to fasten the clips on the matching pink kameez she bought us, and reminded us again that she never wanted to move to California. She cried and begged my dad to stay in Karachi, she told us, but he refused. When he brought her to Berkeley, she did not speak to him for 4 months. My mother had a life in Karachi, but my father was intent on the American dream. Until the end of their relationship, she was too stubborn to let my father forget his betrayal. She had never been particularly religious, but at one point when I was 8, she tried making friends with the women at the mosque in an attempt to find a community that could rival what she had back home. Yet, after 2 weeks, my mother pulled us out of Sunday school, held in the mornings at Berkeley High, claiming that the housewives running the school were indoctrinating us, and were too self-righteous to teach religion. After, she spent Monday mornings teaching us how to make chai and telling stories about Pakistan. She told us about the men who sold chaat on the sidewalks, described the sticky summer air. There was a mall that sold kurtis from Khadi next door to Topshop. In May, when she packed a bag full of our belongings and drove us to the international terminal at SFO, the biggest shock was that she stayed behind, waving with a slight smile as we disappeared past TSA and onto the other side. On the plane, Mariam and I watched the city disappear below us, and I wondered if it was the U.S. that ruined my parents, or us. My nanny was the one to greet us at the other end, a 78-year-old woman who lived alone. She had only just retired from teaching economics at a college for women before we arrived, a job that had been her entire life. During her tenure, she wrote 3 books and let her 2 children raise each other, something she seemed to regret now. It was as though she had learned too late the materials needed to be a mother, and was using us as her makeup test, or maybe a new assignment to keep her busy during the long summer days. In any case, the girls were in Karachi, so she let herself slip into the role, and we allowed her. because we did not have another option. After we moved in, my grandmother would pull out my mother's old photo albums often, convinced that hidden among the photographs was an explanation as to why she left us. She showed us photos, all of them the same. My mother with lips stained red with lipstick, my mother laughing at a joke surrounded by three boys, my mother in a short summer dress, a woman who was independent, sure of herself. She told us, "Your mother always said she wanted two girls." She informed us, lost in the photographs, that Mariam reminds her of my mother, but not me. I took after my father in every way, broad with black curls. I have his nose, his poor eyesight, his humor that always pops up at the wrong moments. My mother and sister are tall, have hair that is straight and light brown, and are the constant center of attention. My favorite photo is from their wedding day. My father has his head pulled back in laughter over something his brother-in-law had whispered to him. My mother wears red, with brown hair styled in big waves, and a nose ring the size of my fist affixed to her nose. She sits up straight at his side, eyes down and mouth curved into a scowl. It is the happiest day of her life, and she is immortalized as regal, cold, and for once, just like me. Nani would refer to Mariam and me as the girls. I was in love with it, proud to have our identities so conflated. I was all for losing my identity if it meant I could take my sisters instead. Only 2 years separated us in age, but when we were younger, she forced me to call her Appa instead of Mariam, a sign of respect she did not deserve, refusing to acknowledge me until I gave in. Growing up, I used to get upset when my sister was allowed to do something I was not. "If Mariam jumped off a bridge, would you jump off too?" my mother would always ask. "Yes," I would respond each time, without hesitation. That summer, Mariam never once comforted me and was still rude, condescending, and superior like always. But my 16-year-old sister, who wanted nothing to do with me in California, let me follow her wherever she went and never once said a word. Our parents had our U.S. passports made years ago, in part for vacations to London and Istanbul, and in part to remind themselves that they could. We had never been to Karachi before. Yet, by looking at Mariam, you could never tell that it was her first time here. She began to speak the language like a natural, and learned to navigate the roads quickly, whereas I refused to speak Urdu and found all the streets blending into one made of sand that turned black in the rain. After a few weeks, when she began to get antsy sitting in the house all day, my grandmother sent us to her friend's house. Her grandson was getting married within the week, and preparations were in full swing. Women floated around making party favors and choreographing dances for the mehandi that would occur the night before the wedding. The younger brother of the groom-to-be drinks beer out of a can openly, indifferent to the fact that he is not yet 18 and drinking is banned in Pakistan. His name is Ziad, and when he speaks, the entire room listens, suspended as he tells a story about how he and a friend were robbed at gunpoint the other night, a common occurrence late at night. They gave the men their new iPhones, money, and the fancy wallets that held it, too wealthy to miss them, and left unscathed. Composed, he looks at Mariam the entire time, trying to impress her and smiling when he does. He drives us home at the end of the day and comes inside when he realizes my grandmother's not home yet. They walk up the stairs to the bedroom. We share and shut the door behind them. The night of the wedding, Mariam and the boy sit next to me as my sister keeps her body arched towards me in an effort to include me in their conversation. I do not reciprocate, as I am angry at her for making new friends and how easy it is for her to betray me. Instead, I stare openly at the couple seated at the front of the hall, the way they whisper to each other and revel in the fact that they are the center of attention for the night. The bride wears red, with brown hair styled in big waves, and a nose ring the size of my fist affixed to her nose. I watch her all night, noting how she smiles in every picture. One night, the electricity shut off, and the generator was taking too long to turn on. Mariam shook me awake, watching me squint to adjust my eyes to the dark. We had grown used to this load shedding when the electric companies would shut off power in specific areas to prevent the overworked system from collapsing entirely. She led me outside and up to the roof, dragging a blanket behind her and setting it down on the flat concrete. It was cooler outside. All the roofs in Karachi were flat, accessible by stairs, and barricaded with short fences. Karachi, the third most populated city in the world, was grimy and busy and powerful. You could watch the street move underneath you from the rooftops, but no one in the city ever did. When she declared that night on the roof that she no longer loved our mother, I, like a good younger sister, agreed. I let go of the time she stayed up with me, pasting paper onto cardboard to complete the science project I'd forgotten to do. I let go of the time my mother held a mango party in the summer, buying crates of the sweet fruit, mango ice cream, mango juice, and let us gorge ourselves for dinner. Instead, I remembered how I curled into myself that night, my stomach twisting from the sickly sweetness of it all. "You can expect it with fathers," Mariam informed me that night, "but mothers are supposed to stay." I latched on to the woman Mariam saw, the woman who left. My mother told me once that she had jumped off this very roof, just to see if she could stick the landing. She did. I tried to imagine my mom in this space. Before that summer, I was naive enough to think that my mother did not have an entire world before me, despite all the stories she had told me of Pakistan. But in Karachi, in my mother's old home, she haunted me, even though I was furthest I had ever been from her. Mariam threw her legs over the railing and jumped. I wondered if she remembered the same story as I did, but for the first time, I did not follow when she jumped. She broke her arm in the fall, told me the next day that she wished she had done worse, and then it was time to go home. California was too clean compared to Karachi, where the seaside was littered with empty soda bottles and wrappers from the McDonald's across from the parking lot. I thought it would be easy to let the city wash over me, to forget I ever left it. I expected relief and comfort from the fact that I could drink water from the taps and not have to rinse my teeth with bottles of Nestle water. Karachi was never perfect, but it never tried to be. As we left the airport, driving the 40 minutes back home, I feel strange passing a landscape that was once so familiar, that my mind was so quickly able to forget. Berkeley, with its homeless encampments teetering against bright murals, seemed at a loss as to who it wanted to be. The brownstone my mother led us into had crooked steps, a fresh coat of paint, 3 stories, 3 bedrooms, and a slanted roof. She walked us through the kitchen, demonstrating how she could light her candles just by turning a knob on the gas stove. "It's just like the one in Pakistan," she notes, watching the blue flames jump at her. Finally, she brought us into a bedroom, where a man was hammering the frames of one of the 2 twin beds that would become ours. The stranger stood up, brushing past us to pull my mother in for a kiss. "Welcome home," he said. My mother did not like surprises, but she was a different person now. Now she was a woman who thought surprising us with strangers and a new home after a summer of exile would make us feel at home. She was a woman who spent her evenings entertaining the colleagues of her boyfriend, white intellectuals who never pronounced her name right. She acted as though all it would take to fix things was a homecoming party with American food and a small serving of nihari we had to go pick up ourselves. Mariam is back to her California self, unnecessarily cruel in the way that only older sisters are allowed to be, and even more distant now that she has left Ziad miles away. I hover on the outskirts of a party that is meant to be mine, arms crossed, face wiped of expression. Strangers approach us, inquiring if the trip was educational, if it was nice to return to our roots as though California had not claimed us first. "Do any of them even know where Karachi is?" I complain to Mariam later. Maybe this is all a lesson. My mother finally teaching her American girls what foreign felt like. After dinner, at the party, a woman touched my shoulder from behind, jumping back a little when I turned to face her. She was one of my mother's old co-workers, a woman who kept her company during the night shifts at the hospital. "Oh, I thought you were your mother," she apologized. "I was looking for her so I could say goodbye." The woman begins to walk away, but hesitates for a second. "Has anyone ever told you," she adds as an afterthought before turning away, "you carry yourself just like your mother." When the guests had left and her boyfriend went downstairs to get a cup of water, I entered my mother's new room to say goodnight. She sat at the vanity and removed her makeup. I leaned in to give her a hug, looking at our reflections in the mirror. It is at the end of the day, but the scent of my mother's perfume still lingers, a floral jasmine I could not place before Karachi. There, the flowers, small, white, and fragrant, are turning into bracelets and necklaces. Young boys stand at the stoplights with racks of them, sliding them through half-cracked windows in exchange for rupees whenever the traffic comes to a lull. My grandmother had brought me one of those bracelets once. When the petals wilted, I asked her if we could buy seeds to try to plant the flower when I returned home in the fall. But she refused, laughing at my ignorance. the flower would never bloom in California. All right, that was kind of a heavy article, so we're going to switch it up and move to 17 Magazine. The essay writer here is giving us some style advice, and this essay is called Here's the Real Reason Why I Thrift All My Clothes. I've always loved clothes, but as a climate justice activist, I'm extra aware of how fast fashion, or clothes produced rapidly by mass market retailers in response to the latest trends, is harming the environment. It's a harsh reality, but many of our go-to clothing stores are contributing to the climate crisis in a big way. Luckily, we've got options. Thrifting, clothing swaps, and hand-me-downs are helping define our generation's style by making us more creative in the ways we dress. I wear vintage clothes I find in the back of my mom's closet. Blazers over jeans is my go-to for school. I thrift with my babysitting money whenever I have the time, sometimes with friends, other times on my own. I love finding pieces that are one of a kind and genuinely feel like me. And I'm not alone. I met up with a few of my friends for a secondhand fashion photo shoot and to talk about thrifting tips, clothing swaps, raiding our parents' closets, and saving the world. Here's what they had to say. When I go thrifting, I'm usually on the hunt for comfy old t-shirts, cheap jeans, and just strange, funky clothes that I can incorporate into my everyday life. My favorite find is a Letterman jacket that I came across while thrifting with my friend Sam. Fast fashion is a waste of resources, and most people feel entitled to purchase as they please without thinking of how it may affect anyone or anything else. Buying things that someone already owned totally helps. Why purchase something that was made by a child or shoved into a machine and made out of plastic? Why support something like that? And that's from Soma Jackson, who is 17 years old. I acquire most of my pieces from clothing swaps. It's a great practice to reduce waste and to find clothes that range from the basics that everyone needs to more personalized, flashy items. I often find myself wearing my mother's old clothes. She was my size in her 20s, so I snatched up a couple of her tank tops. I also wear my abuela's clothes. One of my favorite pieces is a tube top that she gave me. I like shopping at secondhand stores because it never feels like I'm going out of my way to dress a certain way. It feels like a very natural selection process. I go out with very few expectations, so it allows me to keep an open mind when looking for clothes. I find myself buying things I wouldn't have bought 2 years ago. It feels like most pieces I get have their own individual energy attached. And that is from Thalia M., who is also 17 years old. I always look through every shirt in the men's section. Sometimes they have really great graphic tees or shirts with musicians or movies I like. I like to think that I am helping the state of the environment when I thrift. When I really like something from a fast fashion brand, I have to remind myself what went into that shirt or pair of pants. Shopping at thrift stores or wearing hand-me-downs is a small way of working towards a sustainable lifestyle. And that's Emma Linderman, 17 years old. I'm super indecisive, so when I go to the thrift store, I either have something super specific in mind or no idea at all about what I want to buy. But for when I do have an idea, I try to see if I can find a way to recreate or bring to life the outfit I am envisioning. I try to mix things up and give all my clothes a little love. That's from Maya Delmont, 16 years old. I usually go for the t-shirt section first in thrift stores. They're usually at a decent price point, and sometimes the shirts are super soft from wear and washes, and I love that. I have definitely raided my mom's closet, but she's also given me a bunch of clothes she used to wear when she was young and a baddie. They're really cool clothes, and it's fun imagining my mom wearing them in her 20s. They are amazing pieces that I'd never be able to find in retail stores, and others that every fast fashion retailer is replicating at the speed of light. I'm trying to avoid buying anything from fast fashion places anymore. Thrifting is sort of the perfect solution. There's a crazy variety of stuff out there. That's Crystal Lynn, 17 years old. My favorite vintage shoes are this pair of lace-up Oxford-style shoes from the late 50s and 60s, and they are rainbow. They're Italian leather and by far the best quality shoes I own. I'm planning on wearing them to prom. I bring friends to thrift with me, and hopefully soon we will shift away from fast fashion brands and towards a more sustainable way of buying clothing. I also love going to vintage clothing stores with my mom because she always picks out the best stuff. And that's Noah Greenstein, 17 years old. When I go thrifting, I usually look for button-down shirts or Hawaiian shirts with eye-catching prints. I also love a good jacket or sweater. My favorite one-of-a-kind piece is this super soft jacket with baggy sleeves and some type of paisley pattern. It's just so extra. I love turning people's heads and being a maximalist. Thrift shopping always takes longer than shopping at department stores. This is because everything is one of a kind and not everything fits you. You really have to dig and hope you come across some pleasant surprises. And that was from Jiayu Wang, 16 years old. For as long as I can remember, my closet has mostly consisted of hand-me-downs from friends and family thrifted clothes. This summer, when I was in Sweden, I got this oversized black vintage leather jacket that I've worn so much, I feel it is now an extension of my body. And that last quote is from Isabella Palma, also 17 years old. The author of this article is Grace Goldstein. She's a 17-year-old writer, composer, and activist from New York City. This next article is from IndieWire, and it is called Here's Why It Took Over 100 Years Before Harriet Tubman Finally Got a Biopic. And that's out. That movie, Harriet, is out in theaters right now. I actually just saw it today. It was very good. When Cassie Lemons got the chance to direct the first feature-length biopic about Harriet Tubman, she faced a delicate challenge. I really wanted to create a film that a sophisticated 10-year-old could see with his grandmother, which isn't easy for a film that takes place during slavery, she said. And then I wanted to really be able to represent Harriet as accurately as I could, while still making an entertaining movie that would reach a broad audience. Tubman's extraordinary tale has been iconic for generations. Her escape from slavery and ability to free hundreds of slaves forever changed the course of history. But Lemons' situation helps to explain why it took so long for Hollywood to finally recognize the life and accomplishments of a legendary American freedom fighter. Since the 1978 Cicely Tyson miniseries, A Woman Called Moses, film and TV projects on Tubman have been floating around. The most prominent among them was a planned HBO adaptation of historian Kate Clifford Larson's 2004 book, Bound for the Promised Land, which Viola Davis was attached to star in and produce, but it never happened. According to Davis, speaking with Entertainment Weekly in 2016, the reason her life has not been honored, the reason people don't know what she contributed, is because she's a black woman. She was born a slave. If you look up the history of anyone who contributed to the country who were not white males, their contributions are always minimized. Recent films about historic black figures, from Hidden Figures to Nate Parker's divisive Nat Turner film Birth of a Nation, address this neglect by telling stories about real-life revolutionary African Americans that aren't taught in history classes. And now, more than 100 years after her death, the long wait for a Harriet Tubman biopic is over. Lemons' Harriet, starring Cynthia Erivo, finally opens this week after years of development. The project came together in 2016, with Macro super agent Charles D. King leading the charge, along with producers Deborah Martin Chase and Daniela Taplin-Lundberg. Prolific TV director Seth Mann was initially set to direct from a screenplay by Gregory Allen Howard. After Mann exited the project, Lemons took over about a year later and rewrote the script. I think one thing that helped move our project forward was the determination of our producers, who had been with the project for a long time, she said, name-checking Chase and Lundberg. Daniela was so determined to get the movie made that she said if nobody stepped up to partner with us, she was going to finance it herself. Lundberg didn't have to worry. With the core team and script in place, the project was pitched to Focus Features, who came on board in late 2018. The company was just coming off the success of Spike Lee's Black Klansman, another story about historic racism that managed to find its way to mainstream audiences. The film grossed nearly $50 million domestically and won an Oscar for Lee's screenplay. With Harriet on track for a wide release, Lemons had to do her homework. Her primary sources were Tubman biographies, including the 1869 Scenes in the Life of Harriet Tubman, which historians consider unreliable, and the aforementioned Bound for the Promised Land, but she also read academic papers on Tubman and the Underground Railroad. Additionally, she accessed firsthand accounts based on what she described as a kind of one-woman show that Tubman performed, during which she would entertain abolitionists with her story. In the process, Lemons came closer to understanding the spiritual dimension of Tubman's legacy. I'd heard of the premonitions she had, but I really wasn't aware of how very accurate they were, which is all kind of mind-blowing to learn, Lemons said. As a child, Tubman's mother read her Bible stories, and while she never learned to read, she is said to have had an incredible memory, memorizing long passages of scripture that informed her oratory later in life. She pursued visions that she believed were planted in her by God, urging her to flee northward as she led slaves to freedom. Lemon said she stuck to historical records about Tubman over folklore. But the movie is not without some dramatic embellishments and some fictional characters. These include Gideon, Harriet's young, conflicted slave owner, Joe Alwyn. Lemons also plays loosely with some of the dates in the film, such as the Fugitive Slave Act, which was passed much earlier than the film indicates. But the movie's realistic foundation comes from Erivo as its lead. Like Harriet, who is tiny, muscular, fast, strong, fierce, and West African, Cynthia is also a tremendous force of nature, Lemons said. Together, we really tried to invoke Harriet, with Cynthia preparing herself in every way you could possibly be prepared to play the role. Physically, intellectually, spiritually, and emotionally. So by the time she showed up on set for the first day of filming, as soon as she put on the costume and we did the first take, it was like, oh my God, there she is. There's Harriet. The movie was primarily shot in Central Virginia, where the production team capitalized on a large collection of backlots from previous period productions of TV miniseries like John Adams and films like Lincoln. Lemons said that backdrop made for a particularly emotional shoot. We shot on a plantation that was once home to something like 1,000 slaves, and other places where enslaved people had lived, suffered, and died for many, many years, she said. And so, yes, it was at times very tough, but also elevating in a way, because you come to see what we have to face as a country if we're going to heal. Tubman's story has taken on new resonance in 2019, as the movie opens in a violently divided America in which Tubman's own legacy continues to struggle for appreciation. In 2016, the Obama administration announced that the $20 bill would be redesigned by 2020, removing the face of Andrew Jackson, a president who also owned slaves, and replacing it with anti-slavery activist Tubman's. However, the Trump administration continues to delay the move. Earlier this year, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin announced that the final decision on a redesign of the bill had been postponed until 2026, with new bills coming out no earlier than 2028. Should it eventually happen, Tubman would be the first woman to feature on U.S. banknotes in over a century. The last time and only time this happened was when Martha Washington, George Washington's wife, appeared on a $1 silver certificate in the late 1800s. Lemons entertained the notion that the release of the movie implies that Tubman's spirit continues to play a role in modern society. Cynthia and I like to believe that it does very much seem like this is when Harriet would have wanted the film to happen, Lemons said. The timing just couldn't be better. All right, we have run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazines. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Romani Arrowsmith, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.